Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring Reflections on Paul Harvey. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Sirius XM Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. btb@museum.tv. And in hour number one this evening, we are going to be offering reflections on Paul Harvey. In hour number two, we'll be talking about the latest political news in America. But America was stunned yesterday with word that an American icon was dead. Paul Harvey was, in my view, the greatest American broadcaster, a master of words and speech, a man who brought intellect, dignity, and humor to each of his broadcasts, and demonstrated an ability to connect to his audience for over six decades, a remarkable career, one that is not likely ever to be replicated. He was the most listened-to man in the history of American radio, his voice heard by more than any other performer before or since. And I'm very happy to say that Paul Harvey also was a friend of mine, a close friend, an inspiration to me as a young man, and a friend to me as I grew older, and as he grew older, and hopefully each of us grew wiser. If the transmitters who carry the radio signals to America's population, if they all had flags, those flags should be at half-staff tonight, because America has lost one of its own, the true conscience of the radio industry. And as our first hour unfolds this evening, I want to hear your reaction to Paul Harvey at 1-800-723-8289. But we'll also be hearing from people throughout the radio industry as hour number one unfolds this evening. Paul Harvey, as you all know, loved radio. He also loved Chicago. In fact, in 1992, he was the very first host of the Radio Hall of Fame broadcast from the Chicago Cultural Center. And in those opening remarks, it was clear this was a man that loved radio and loved his devoted hometown of Chicago.
Good evening, American. What Cooperstown is to baseball, Chicago is to broadcasting. This is where Major League Radio began. Guy Lombardo from the Edgewater Beach and Wayne King from the Aragon Ballroom, Amos and Andy and Jack Armstrong, Chicago was home for Fibber McGee and Molly, Don McNeil's Breakfast Club, birthplace of the daytime soaps. And now, the Radio Hall of Fame has come home to Chicago.
And with those words, he ushered in an era of the Radio Hall of Fame. And a little bit later on in the broadcast, I will talk about how Paul and Angel Harvey, in the kitchen of their home in Phoenix, Arizona, their winter home in Phoenix, Arizona, really came up and solidified the support that made the Radio Hall of Fame possible. Paul Harvey was an inspiration to me and to literally tens of thousands of broadcasters, because everyone, most people in broadcasting, have some Paul Harvey story. It may be an experience with their fathers, their grandfathers. They may have worked a radio station. They may be working on a 500-watt radio station listening to this program this evening. But Paul Harvey has touched their lives. And in 1958, when my father used to take me to drive me to school every day, at least the latter years of grade school, Monroe School on the northwest side of Chicago, before I got out of the car every day, we would listen to Paul Harvey on the radio. And then we would briefly talk about what Paul Harvey was talking about that day. It was news, it was politics, it was opinion. Then later that night over the dinner table, we would continue to talk about what Paul Harvey had talked about on the radio. And so my bonding experience, my most significant bonding experience with my father, was every day in the front seat of a 1948 Plymouth listening to Paul Harvey on the radio. And 30-plus years later, to have Paul Harvey become a friend meant a great deal to me. But it also really ushered in a situation, an era of the relationship of Paul Harvey, not only to myself, because that story that I just shared can be shared by others as well. He was a great friend. And when you ran into Paul Harvey, as big and as important, because fame and fortune had been his for most of his adult life, his first words were always about, how are you doing? How's the show doing? We would talk about the museum. We would talk about the Radio Hall of Fame. We would certainly talk about politics. He was interested in my opinions and would frequently call me and ask for my thoughts on a particular candidate who was rising. In fact, I remember about a year and a half ago, he asked me about this guy, Barack Obama. And he said he wanted to meet Barack Obama someday. I don't think he ever did, but I know he was very interested in the rise of Barack Obama coming up, from the political streets of Chicago to go on become president of the United States. But again, he would always say, how you doing? How are the affiliates? How many affiliates do you have now? And he and Angel would listen to this broadcast and watch it, as many of you are watching it right now if you're listening in the city of Chicago. He was, as I said, he was the conscience of the industry. He fell in love with radio at a very young age. It was his high school teacher who liked the way he talked and liked the way he wrote, and introduced them to a radio station owner down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's where he started by sweeping the floors and working every job in radio, as many of the people who are listening to this broadcast along the network line this evening have similar experiences. Paul Harvey was a broadcaster's broadcaster. And he was very proud of his roots, the values that he brought to the broadcast. He turned down all kinds of pressure to go to the East Coast, to New York or Washington to originate his program, but he wanted to stay true to his Midwestern values in the Chicagoland area. And so he planted his flag in Chicago in 1944 is when he came to the city with Lynn Angel Harvey, his beloved partner and wife for many, many years. They fell in love with Chicago. They became part of the social and cultural fabric of this city. And in 1951, when he was working at the Merchandise Mart, this is when the Blue Network and the Red Network were still together. They were one. This was before ABC really became a network of its own. He befriended a man by the name of Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy owned the Merchandise Mart. He was the father of President John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Ted Kennedy. And he liked this young radio announcer that he would occasionally have lunch with. And so Joe Kennedy put in the good word with a few friends in New York to watch out for this young up-and-comer coming from Chicago. It turned out that it was Paul Harvey. And in 1951, he signed a contract with ABC Radio. And the rest is history, becoming the most listened to, the most successful broadcaster of all time, talking to more people than you could imagine. And again, in addition to those Midwestern values that were so near and dear to him, he also thought about Aunt Betty. He really did have an Aunt Betty. And before he would go on the air or do a broadcast, he would say, how is Aunt Betty going to respond to this? Because he wanted to do shows and he wanted to tell stories that were important to people listening all over the country. Not the biggest and most important people in town, but those who work every single day. And if it was important to Aunt Betty, he figured it was probably important to a lot of people. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to some of the people who affected his lives and also your telephone calls at 1-800-723-8289 as tonight we offer reflections on the late, great Paul Harvey. From Fayetteville, North Carolina to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. In hour number one this evening, we're offering reflections on Paul Harvey, who passed away yesterday at age 90. And let us go to Tony in Manteno, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship WLS radio. Go ahead.
Hi. About 15 years ago, I had the fortunate opportunity to seeing Mr. Paul Harvey. My wife and I were staying at the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia, which, as I understand, is where he frequented quite often.
That's right. It was one of their favorites.
Yes. And we were at, I believe it was dinner. I'm not sure which meal exactly. And I noticed him. And I've been a real fan of his since I was just a teenager. And I told my wife, I said, now don't turn around too quickly, but when you get a chance, turn around and you know, let me see, tell me who you think that is. And so she turned around and she turned back and she looked at me and her eyes got real wide and she said, "That's Red Skelton." And of course, I think Red Skelton had been deceased at that time. But anyway, I explained to her that that was Paul Harvey. And I was on pins and needles the whole time. I couldn't even hardly eat my meal because I'd been such a fan, wanting to go up and shake his hand, but yet wanting to give him the privacy that he deserves. He was with his wife, and I believe his son.
So did you ever do it? Did you ever go up and talk to him?
I did not. I did not. I kind of chickened out, and I thought better of it. I thought, well, he's there enjoying himself, and maybe he doesn't need anybody, you know, there.
Well, he would have loved for you to reach out and talk to him. Believe me, because he was very approachable and would have said hello. And we thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us at the beginning of the program and in many of the stories that have been written thus far. So much has been said and written about the power and influence and the success that Paul Harvey enjoyed on the radio. There is someone who knows a great deal about success in radio. He is Bill Kelly. He joins us from Youngstown, Ohio. He is the Clear Channel Market Manager for Youngstown, Ohio, which includes WKBN, one of our longest affiliates on Beyond the Beltway. And Bill, thank you very much for joining us on Beyond the Beltway.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored that you would invite me to be part of this program today.
Well, I know in the numerous times that I've done remotes from Youngstown, you and I have always gone out to dinner, and part of that conversation all the time deals with Paul Harvey and stories that you recall about Paul and about Paul's commitment and interest in the Museum of Broadcast Communications. But as a radio professional, as someone who looks at ratings and knows about the importance of the sales aspect of radio, what did Paul Harvey mean to the industry and to ABC as a whole?
Well, I was thinking about this after you asked me to be on the program, and Paul Harvey has been part of radio stations I've either programmed or managed since 1974. And Paul Harvey always brought credibility to the radio station. And he was able to mix something that maybe a lot of people don't pay attention to, but it's really even true today. He was really the only commentator up until Limbaugh, and really I don't think you could put them in the same class, so let me take that back. He was really the only commentator who was able to do news, do commentary, and also pitch products. That was a taboo, and really still is today. You don't see the anchor men and women in Chicago news doing commercials. He was able to mix it, and he was able to mix it with great credibility. So as a result, he brought a good newscast to your radio station. You brought a very credible newscast to your radio station, a wonderful personality to your radio station. He was able to sell products for his parent network, and you, as a local radio affiliate, were able to sell what we call in our business adjacencies, commercials that either go before or after the broadcast, and you were able to command very high rates for those advertisements because they were bumped up against Paul Harvey.
And whereas there are some critics who criticized him because he did commercials and had a commercial element about him, I mean, Paul Harvey, he was very proud that he was a salesman and a pitchman. He said that he was proud that he could sell product and sell ideals. And that's what he was
right.
able to do.
He did such due diligence on his product.
Yes.
That there was no doubt that he believed in them when he did the commercials for them. But, you know, he was part of the building blocks that we originally wanted to go after when we decided to flip WKBN to News Talk many years ago. And it was very rough to do because in those days, in the early to mid-80s, the networks frowned on being on each other's radio stations. We were one of the first CBS radio affiliates in the country, and Paul Harvey being with ABC, neither network wanted to have anything to do with that kind of a deal. So it was only when CBS nationwide relaxed its requirement that you carry absolutely every single newscast from beginning to end, that radio stations such as the one that I happen to manage were able to merge a product from ABC and have it on a radio station that was basically a CBS affiliate.
Bill, I have said in some of the interviews that I've done since hearing of Paul's death last evening is that there will never be another Paul Harvey because no network would ever allow someone of that nature to get as much power as he did because he had editorial control of his broadcasts, and basically he could select the commercials from a long line of people that usually were waiting in line for maybe a couple of years so that they could pay maybe $1 million a year or more to have Paul Harvey do their spots.
I think your point is well taken. I believe that the network that carries Paul Harvey will have to try something, because that's a tremendous amount of money to lose. But Paul Harvey did enjoy power that nobody else will have. There are some people who locally have that kind of power, but they're not newscasters. They're talk show hosts.
Right.
And Paul Harvey was, first and foremost, a news anchor. He never lost sight of that. We, as general managers, never lost sight of that. He was not a talk show host. He was a commentator.
No, he was not. In fact, I cringe because I know that some of the quick thumbnail sketches have referred to him as a talk show host. And again, he was proud that he was a newsman, I know. And having witnessed him work, I mean, he would get up about 3:30 in the morning. He'd be at his desk, on the 16th floor at 333 North Michigan, where he did his broadcast for 35 or 40 years. And literally when he walked in, someone had gotten all the wire stories, and they had piled them in a variety, the serious stories, the foreign affairs stories, the kickers, the little funny stories at the end of the broadcast, and they were all laid out for him. But it was Paul Harvey who went through and read each of those stories to determine the stories that and the content that was going into those shows. And he didn't read it off the wire story. He would then take a sheet of yellow paper, he would put it in his Selectric typewriter as he was looking up North Michigan Avenue, and literally he would type in his own, in his own style. He would do a rewrite of that particular story. And so this was a guy, every word that you heard him utter, at least insofar as the news and commentaries, were words that he wrote. So it was, he really was a master of both the words and the music of radio.
He was able to do something that every good radio personality still needs to do, no matter whether they're playing music or doing a talk show or seriously anchoring a newscast at the top of the hour. He was able to reach out and touch his audience. People need to strive to do that, but nobody will do it the way Paul Harvey did it.
Bill Kelly, thank you very much for joining us tonight. From WKBN in Youngstown, Ohio, Bill Kelly, and you talk about reaching out and touching people and painting word pictures. There was none better than Paul Harvey. And in 1995, he participated in the 75th anniversary of radio. And this is how the program began.
Good evening, Americans. In the beginning, there was void. The earth was cloaked in day and dark and barren silence. And Guglielmo Marchesi Marconi said, "Let there be music in the air, and voices, and singing, and preaching, and praying, and laughter in the air." And so he created radio. And then one November day, the 100-watt voice of KDKA told anybody within 10 miles of East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that Warren Harding had been elected President of the United States. On that historic date, for both Paul Harvey and Radio News, the world began. Both, I am told, entered the world noisily. So you can see why, inevitably, my perspective is partly personal.
Paul Harvey in 1995, celebrating the 75th anniversary of radio. And again, that was a memorable Radio Hall of Fame, and that with about 48 hours to go before the 75th anniversary of the entire medium, the host who had been selected was Tom Snyder. And he called up and said, "Bruce, I've got laryngitis. I can't talk." And so we had to do a complete rewrite on that entire broadcast. The producers and I, with just a very short time left, Paul Harvey agreed. He had agreed to be a participant in the broadcast. We sort of expanded his role. We also brought in the great Fred Foy, the announcer on the Lone Ranger, to also help us that evening. So that is one of the fond memories of the many times that Paul Harvey stepped up to help out yours truly and to help out the radio industry, because he loved it so much. And again, we're offering reflections tonight, and yours will be coming up when we continue. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. From Bangor, Maine to Tulsa, Oklahoma, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, Tulsa, Oklahoma, the hometown of Paul Harvey. And in segment number one, I talked about my bonding experience with my father listening to Paul Harvey on the radio. Paul Harvey did not have a similar experience because he lost his father when Paul was only 4 years old. His father was a law enforcement officer in Oklahoma and was killed in the line of duty. And one of the things that Paul Harvey would do when he would look through his daily reports, whenever he learned that there was a police officer who had been killed in the line of duty, not every time, but frequently, he would reach out either to that family or to the benevolent organization in that city that deals with those left behind by a police officer killed in the line of duty, and he would support that organization. So it was the quiet side of Paul Harvey, but again, going back to a childhood memory, being raised by a mother and by his aunt. Let us go to calls. Let's go to Boise, Idaho. Jeff is listening to us on KBOI. Nice to hear from Boise tonight.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how are you, sir?
Pretty good. I can remember back in the mid-60s, I was in junior high school, and lunchtime would come. A bunch of boys would pile in the car, would go to a drive-in. 12 o'clock, Paul Harvey would come on, and all us boys would listen to him. And he's been a part of my life for the past, more than 50 years. And I've listened to him ever since, and I don't know why a bunch of little kids would listen to him 15, 16 years old, but we just love to listen to him.
Well, again,
I hardly wait for his tagline.
Yeah.
Paul Harvey, good day.
Yeah. Well, I know when I was in 7th and 8th grade, maybe at the beginning I felt like I was being sort of forced to listen. But after a few weeks, I couldn't wait to hear his stories. And one of the, in listening to the stories of Paul Harvey, the one that sticks out was hearing the news that Roy Campanella, the great Brooklyn Dodger catcher, was in an automobile accident and was going to be paralyzed. And the way that Paul Harvey broke that story and told that story, it's as fresh in my mind as if it had happened yesterday. And it is those vivid storytelling techniques and skills that he had that, as you say, 50 years later, you still consider him a friend. And again, he came into your life a long time. Let's reach out now to another person who observes the radio industry and does a brilliant job of doing it. He is Al Peterson. He's the president, editor, and chief of NewsTalkSportsMediaOnline.com. And Al, thank you very much for joining us to offer your reflections on the passing of perhaps the greatest radio broadcaster of all time.
Bruce, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
As you look at his impact and the transition of what is likely to happen next, is there going to be a transition to a new voice, a new sound, or is radio with that format not likely to be able to continue on the many stations that currently carry that broadcast?
Well, I certainly couldn't speak for the network, and I'm sure they wouldn't want me to speak for them, but I don't think there's any question that not only just Paul Harvey himself, but the programs that he hosted are literally from a different era of radio broadcasting that it is very different in today's world, the 15-minute news broadcast. I'm not sure that had it been anyone other than Mr. Harvey, that the format that he broadcast in would have lasted as long as it did. So I suspect that there will be some changes, because I just don't believe that there's anyone, no matter how talented they are, and, you know, God bless the folks at ABC Radio Networks. I think they've done a terrific job of looking at various talents, even while often indicating that no one was really auditioning for Paul's job, ultimately. But there is no replacement for Paul Harvey, no matter who that talent might be.
Well, a couple of years ago, the odds-on favorite, because there was a great deal of fanfare when he was announced, was the former senator from Tennessee, Fred Thompson. He did do a couple of sub-jobs for Paul, and then he got the itch to run for president. That was not successful. When that was over, he did not go back to ABC, and it is somewhat ironic, but tomorrow Fred Thompson is going to launch his own daily talk show on some stations through the Westwood One radio network, and perhaps had he stayed where he would, perhaps he'd be sitting in tomorrow replacing Paul Harvey on the ABC radio network.
Well, you know, I spoke with Fred Thompson back when he first did start to fill in over at ABC, and I think that, you know, this is a guy who's certainly no shrinking wallflower and has walked the corridors of power with some of the most powerful people in America and the world. But I think even he was daunted and, might I say, even a little possibly intimidated at the idea of replacing Paul Harvey. And any time I would ask him about it, he said, no, I'm just trying to do what I do. I cannot replace Paul Harvey.
I think that
would have been a tough job. Those are tough shoes.
You did not want to have those two words in the same sentence. And I know I had the honor and pleasure of subbing for Paul on probably about 10 occasions over the last, 15 years. And I will never forget going over to have lunch with Angel Harvey one day. And Angel said, well, Paul's going to join us for lunch. And I said, well, that's wonderful. And, you know, the broadcast was over and we were about to head up to the Tavern Club at 333 North Michigan. And Paul said, come on into, he said, I want to bring you into the studio for a second. So he brings me into the studio, which is a very stark studio. It had a marble top desk, a singular microphone with a backup, two microphones together just in case one went down, but nothing fancy. About as stark a room as one could imagine, almost sterile in its presentation. And he said, why don't you go over there and have a seat? So he motions to me to go over and sit in his spot, and I went and sat down, and I didn't know where he was going with this. So then we proceeded to go to lunch, and about an hour later, in the middle of lunch, he pops the question and says, well, you know, I'm going to be on vacation and going to be off for a few days in a couple of weeks. He said, would you like to sit in for me someday? Mm-hmm. And what a question to get from Paul Harvey. And I said, I gulped and I said, I would be honored. And, you know, a few weeks later, when that opportunity came and getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and going through the ritual that he goes through every day, I don't know how he did it. And, you know, my knees and voice and everything that I had was shaking when that light flipped on. But that was one of the great thrills of my professional life. And he was a guy who offered that opportunity to a number of broadcasters.
You know, it's funny, Bruce, you talk about his 3 a.m. calls in an interview I did with him a number of years ago. And he didn't do a lot of interviews. He really didn't like talking about himself.
No, he did not.
And one of the things that I learned, and I had tried to get an interview with him for time after time, and not through anything other than, no, you know, he's just not ready to do that. Finally, I pitched him on the idea of, and I said, I don't want to talk about yesterday. I want to talk about today and tomorrow. And Paul said, oh, well, that I'm interested in talking about. And I asked him at the time what we would be talking about in the future. And I remember clearly him talking to me saying that he just couldn't wait at 3 or 3:30 every morning, and he was well into his 80s by that time. He said he couldn't wait to race down to the teletypes and the telephones and the fax machines and the Internet and all the different sources that he had. and I remember the quote exactly, to see what foolish and heroic things millions of people have been doing for me to talk about.
Right.
And I never get tired of learning something new every day.
No, that infests interest, and I think it. You saw it dissipate with the passing of Angel last year. It was difficult for anyone who's lost a mate of 60-plus years, but it was difficult to watch, and obviously it affected Paul's ability to go back on the air very quickly. And there was a lot of pressure on Paul Harvey to get back on the air because the affiliates were restless, were they not?
Absolutely, and I got regular calls from affiliates. What are you hearing about Paul coming back? What are you hearing about Paul coming back? And I think that there was never any question of his desire to come back, perhaps up until the death of Angel. And I think that anyone that knew the Harveys, even to a small extent, and I certainly was not close personal friends with the family, but I have met and spent time with both Paul and his wife Angel and with Paul Jr. over the years. And it was the greatest love affair that
Without
I think
question.
I have ever witnessed. The relationship between Paul and the woman that he called his angel was unlike anything I'd seen. They were like two teenagers 50 years into their marriage.
No, that is true.
And it was just really quite quite heartwarming and fascinating to watch them together.
Now, Al, you said that Paul did not like to do interviews. One person that he did interviews with on occasion, someone that he considered a good friend, was Larry King. And Larry
yes.
King actually got him talking about his style once on TV. Let's watch.
Style, which you see yourself imitated on network comedy shows, Saturday Night Live. Guys make a living off you. Did that come to you?
Did Larry King ever sit down and, with enough introspection, imagine what in the world am I going to do for style?
Not
for a minute.
You know it.
No, not for a minute. Nor have I, Larry. It all just evolves over a period of time. I'm asked about the pause between Paul Harvey and Good Day. I remember ABC has threatened for years to sell spot announcements in there. They can't stand that dead air. But that's just a shabby craftsman's way of waiting until the second hand gets around to the right place. So
that was your device?
It really was. Mm-hmm.
So, like, the news would be ending at 14:50 and you'd be at 14:40?
Whenever it ended.
So you'd hold.
Paul Harvey and Larry King. I'm Bruce Dumont. Offering reflections. And Al Peterson, thank you very much for joining us. Back shortly on Beyond the Beltway, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Al Peterson was talking about the love affair between Paul and Angel Harvey. Angel Harvey passed away last May. They met when she was a broadcaster in St. Louis. He asked her to get married on the very first date. And so the memory of Paul and Angel Harvey is something that we will never forget. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Monterey, California. Mark Carbonaro is listening to us. He's part of the morning team on KION. Mark, nice to have you with us tonight.
Hey, Bruce. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And first thing I want to say is to offer my condolences to you on the loss of your good friend.
Thank you very much.
You know, I was just listening to what everybody's had to say about Paul and what a giant he was in the industry. And probably maybe one of the only thing I could add to that is that the man had a tremendous work ethic. And for anyone to be successful in any business, and particularly in broadcasting, you know, you have to do what Paul did. And to get to the top, you've got to work that hard. And then to stay on top like he did, you have to work even harder. And I think that what set him apart from so many people was for how long he was willing to put up with that schedule, because he truly loved it so much. You know, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and being in the studio at 3:30, 5 days a week. And I think one of the great challenges, you know, going forward in trying to find someone to pick up that program is the fact that, you know, I don't know that you can get like a famous voice like a Fred Thompson or someone like that who's not a journalist. I think one of the things that we sometimes forget is that Paul Harvey was a trained news journalist, and he became a commentator and a very skilled deliverer of the news, but you've got to be able to go through all that material every day and pick out the good stuff and know how to write it,
mm-hmm.
and that's a tremendous skill. So I think that, you know, going forward, Bruce, finding somebody who has that same skill set is is what you have to do.
No, and he also told me that, first of all, he says, first of all, you got to spend some time reporting the news, and then you gain enough experience so you can analyze the news, and then after you've done that for maybe a few years or a few decades, then you get to the point to comment on the news. And that's really the way that he saw his role. And again, I think you speak for a lot of people working in the vineyards of radio in what you say and the work ethic that it takes to get to the top. And we thank you very much for sharing your thoughts tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Someone else who works very hard, some might say he's the hardest working guy in radio, and he is the nighttime man on the Westwood One Radio Network, the longtime announcer, remember the Radio Hall of Fame. Jim Bohannon joins us. Jim, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, Bruce, my pleasure. Thank you.
What is your lasting memory of Angel and Paul Harvey? And certainly you had an opportunity to get to know them in your role as the announcer for the Radio Hall of Fame for the last 10 years.
Absolutely, yes. During that time, now over a decade that I've been the announcer, and I had a chance to get to know the Harveys, and it was, I think the thing that amazed me the most about Paul was the extent to which, and I saw that happen year after year. He, of course, would show up and he would be mobbed by people. He always seemed genuinely surprised that many people would be that eager to meet him. He was unfailingly gracious, a genuinely courtly, old-school gentleman, always with a kind word, always with sincere questions about your family and your well-being.
And I also remember that some of the people who were as tickled pink as people who listen to the radio were the inductees that year. I mean, when Garrison Keillor had an opportunity to meet Paul Harvey and sit at his table and have dinner, he was like a kid in a candy store. The same thing with Rush Limbaugh, the same thing with Sean Hannity. I mean, they were absolutely beside themselves that they were in the presence of Paul Harvey.
Oh, no question about that. And talking about that work ethic, I did get a chance to actually meet Paul many, many decades ago. He struck up many friendships across the country with broadcasters and others, but one of them was with a man named Ralph Foster. Ralph Foster owned KWTO in Springfield, Missouri, and in 1966 when I worked there. Paul would frequently go down to KWTO. He would go fishing with Ralph Foster, and he would do his shows, and then he would go off. Usually it would be on a Friday, and then they would go off for the weekend. And to watch him do that and to pour through the mountains of what at the time was wire copy, of course, there were no computers, and just it seemed effortlessly, of course, but it wasn't, to pick out the right stories and then put just the right turn of phrase to put it together. It was, I mean, we were just glued to watching him put that together.
Now, something else that a lot of people haven't commented on yet, but before Rush, before Hannity, before even George Will at the network level, Paul Harvey was the father of conservative political commentators in the country. And although Barry Goldwater was the conscience of the conservative and started the modern political conservative movement, Barry Goldwater used to listen to Paul Harvey. They were friends in Arizona. So Paul Harvey was talking about conservative family values and political ideals long before it was fashionable, back in the 40s and early 50s. And one person also that used to listen to him showed up when the museum honored Paul Harvey in 1988. He, too, was a former broadcaster from the Midwest with Midwestern values. And at that time, he was the president of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Of course.
He was growing up. The harsher the wind, the stronger the tree. For many years, Paul, you have been that strong tree, rooted in the soil of Middle America, gaining strength and constancy against shifting opinions and changing times. That your popularity is greater now than it has ever been is a living testament to the esteem with which you are held by so many Americans.
That was President Ronald Reagan in a video tribute to Paul Harvey in October of 1988 in the Fairmont Hotel in Chicago. And our time is almost up. I want to thank Jim Bohannon for being with us. Jim, we will move forward with the Radio Hall of Fame this year. There'll certainly be a soft spot and a hole in all of our hearts. As I said at the beginning of the program, Paul Harvey was the conscience of the American radio industry, and everywhere tonight in radio stations from coast to coast and border to border, there's a moment of silence, and there's a deepness and a sorrow in all of those stations. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us for Reflections. I'm Paul Harvey. We will continue with hour number two. If you're listening on radio, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Dan Proft, Ralph Martiri, and Philip Beverly of Chicago State University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. That's btb@museum.tv. Last week, of course, the president addressed a joint session of Congress. They didn't call it a State of the Union address, but he certainly laid out some of the fiscal problems that the country faces, offering further details on his budget, proposed budget, stimulus package, and then, of course, talking a lot about energy and education. And there was the Republican response from Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, and we're going to talk about that for the next few minutes on our broadcast. Our Republican tonight is Dan Proft. Dan, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Any surprise in that speech?
No, I mean, I really don't think there was any surprise. It's funny, we talked about this after Obama was elected on this show. Would Obama be the moderate, centrist, center-left president that how he campaigned and certainly what his rhetoric usually is, or would he veer significantly to the left and become much more of an ideologue in the kind of great society FDR fashion? I think we have seen that his rhetoric may sound very centrist. His policies are way left. It is nothing short of neo-socialism. And the fact that they're arguing or they're trying to advance this idea that government spending is some innovative policy idea, we're $10 trillion in debt. It's not like government spending has just recently been tried under President Obama. So I think he is moving the country far left in a hurry, regardless of his very centrist-sounding rhetoric.
Also joining us this evening is Ralph Martiri. He does not answer to the title of Democrat. He's a nonpartisan, and he heads a nonpartisan group called the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Nice to have you with us. You operate in Illinois and several states around the United States. What's your reaction to Dan's assessment of the president's speech, and were you surprised by anything?
You know, I really wasn't surprised by anything. I mean, we have to take a deep step back. I mean, I don't see it as going far left or anything like that. What I see it as is a president who's trying to deal with the greatest economic downturn that we've had since the Great Depression. It may very well be a new depression. I mean, already our recession has lasted 13, 14 months. The average length of every recession since the Great Depression has been only 10 months. So it's a very long-lasting economic downturn. The job reports that just came out this week were significantly worse. The economy shrunk at over 6% when they had estimated it was just over 3%. And he's saying, look, we don't have a lot of tools in the box. One of the tools we have in the box is public spending on infrastructure, on education, on those kinds of things. And we know, in fact, you get a positive multiplier by making these expenditures in the economy. And that's not just Barack Obama talking. It's Mark Zandi of Moody's.com. And Zandi was the economic advisor to McCain in his presidential run, or one of them anyway. And Zandi's identified a number of what these multipliers are, so that for every dollar you expend in the public sector, you get more than a dollar in economic activity. And I think Barack is right to focus on that at this moment.
Now, Philip Beverly also joins us, associate professor at Chicago State. Philip, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
The president certainly was hoping that Wall Street would respond with a huge rally, and that certainly has been a dud.
And they haven't. The market is continuing to plunge, and I don't think we've seen the bottom yet. I think we've got more months of decline until we start to see some turnaround if this is in fact going to work. And it has me think back to the initial package that was put together in the fall under the former Secretary Paulson when he says, I need $700 billion and that might not be enough. I don't know that we know what would be enough in terms of government spending. I think everybody's pretty much got their fingers crossed that this is going to work.
Well, perhaps you're applying the wrong remedy. That's why the $700 billion didn't work. Another $800 billion is not going to work. I mean, the model for this is manifest around us. If we're going to model ourselves after those trendy Western European countries that Obama seems to have such affinity for, then the American people should understand something. Government spending and socialist democracies like France and Germany, if you think 7.6% unemployment is bad now and people are lighting their hair on fire over that, 7.6% unemployment would be 15-year lows in France and Germany. So, again, this idea that socialism, demand-side government spending has not been tried before is just folly. We know what the implications are. And conversely, we know what the implications are when you reduce spending, when you reduce the government burden on families and you let them spend more of their own money.
If things continue to get worse, the Republicans obviously have staked out, you know, all but three members of Congress or three Republicans in Congress have supported the stimulus package. Is there a winning hand politically for the Republicans? Or if they win the hand, is there going to be anything left to celebrate?
Well, look, I mean, I think Republicans have to present a contrast message. You know, the people who keep saying Republicans can't just be a party of no, they can't be a party of no, that's kind of half true. They should be a party of no when it comes to policies that are being advanced, whose implications
we
understand.
Are they doing that?
They're partially doing that. They're a little tepid when it comes to kind of frontal assault on the president because he's relatively popular right now. But they shouldn't focus on personalities. They should focus on policy. And that policy means Republicans being Republicans again, which is owning up to the past mistakes, owning up to their excesses when it came to spending in particular, and talking about those policies that create jobs, that create real economic growth in this country.
Can the Republicans win on this by playing the current card in your view, Ralph?
Well, is
there another side to this coin that you, as someone who watches these issues, you know, night and day, that maybe there is a Republican answer that conceivably could be better than this answer?
Yeah, well, I don't know that the Republicans should be trying to win this battle politically. I think that we're in such a difficult time. I think what the Republicans ought to be doing is staking out a vision, and I don't disagree with you, staking out a vision says this is how we are going to get to economic prosperity, and this is why we know that'll work. The problem is a lot of the most staunch current Republican ideology to point, the policies put into place by George W. Bush that mirrored some of the policies put in by Ronald Reagan have failed. I mean, the two administrations with the lowest job growth since we've kept track of that have been those two administrations. And in fact, near the end of the Bush administration, we could have seen some of these problems coming our way. I mean, the last couple of years he was in office, in our gross domestic product, wages were their lowest percentage, corporate profits were their highest. So businesses were certainly being profitable. The money wasn't going down to mom and pop. It wasn't going down to Main Street at all. And I hate to use trite phrases like that, but it really wasn't. So I think what the Republicans have to do is sort of reinvent some of this old ideological saw that they've been hacking and say, look, at this time, we do think that there's a role for government to play. But we should limit it at X, Y, or Z, wherever that limit is, and we should look at being able to pay our bills at some point in the future. I think that that's a great Republican platform, being responsible fiscally, and something they've lost their way on in the last 8 years.
We're going to follow up on that, 1-800-723-8289. Also, when we come back, we want to get your response to how Governor Jindal did in his first spotlight opportunity as a potential Republican presidential candidate. 1-800-723-8289, from coast to coast and border to border. From Chicago, live, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to go back to calls. Let's go to Mike, listening to us in Spokane, Washington on KXLY. Nice to hear from Western Washington tonight. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Bruce. Yeah, it's Eastern Washington. Thanks.
Eastern, Spokane. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you're right.
Near Idaho there, Coeur d'Alene. But, yeah, we listened to Paul Harvey here in Spokane, and, you know, he found something special about every person, no matter who or what they were. I know once my boss wanted to listen to to Paul Harvey before we started work, so I was thinking, go, Paul Harvey, go. I was hoping for 2 hours of Paul Harvey. So probably lots of wakes in Chicago tonight. If not, there should be.
Well, this is, again, for those listening around the country, in addition to the death of Paul Harvey, Chicago was rocked this week by the loss of Norm Van Leer and Red Kerr, a longtime players and broadcasters for the Chicago Bulls. So it's going to be a week of funerals and memorial services in Chicago. But you you were calling about a stimulus-related question or Illinois political-related question as it affects national politics?
Actually, Bruce, and I want to say a few positive words about Illinois and Chicago, too. It's the land of Lincoln, the land of Everett Dirksen, the land of E.J. Stevenson. And so before cities and states can start casting stones about the political situations in Chicago, we have to look at our own cities and our own states. Our own backyards need cleaning up as well. So I just want to bring that up as well. Illinois is a great state, and they've been getting a lot of hard things going on.
Mike, let me. We're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later on the show, but I want to ask you on the economic stimulus package situation, how has the economic downturn affected you, if it has at all?
Well, it hasn't. It has not yet, Bruce. Thank God, I'm in sales, newspapers, and I'm still making sales. But there's some impact.
You're in sales and newspapers, and things are going well?
No, it's not. It's not, Bruce. I mean, I hear it every day. People are out of work, and our own newspaper has been laying people off, so it's not going well at all, as you know. No, newspapers are not going well, even here in Spokane. But we're doing better than some papers. But I hear it every day when I talk to people who are out of work or they're just working part-time or they're looking for work, and I hear it more and more every day.
Thank you very much for your call. Let us go to Turner, listening to us in Missouri. He's on the highway, listening to us on WLS tonight. Go ahead, Turner. You're on the air.
Hi. Interesting discussion tonight. I was just reading a letter from Michael Steele, the new chairman of the Republican Party, soliciting donations, and he mimics some of the things that I'm hearing tonight. I'm hearing around the country that about what Republicans need to do, and I'm not so sure it's going to be that easy. His message is, well, Republicans need to return to what they're supposed to be good at, which is fiscal conservatism, et cetera, but. I look at what happened in the 30s, and Republicans just beat that drum over and over again, basically criticizing the other party, and they got nowhere. And I think it's just a tough road. I think the thing that George Bush did effectively was get people like me, the people they call neocons, people that used to be Democrats but really liked the strong America, the human freedom aspect that Bush supported, and were willing to learn some Republican values. The Republicans need to get those people back, hang on to them, and they need to shed some of this extreme libertarian flavor that's seeped in the Republican Party, and that's tough.
I want to get reaction. I want to get reaction from everybody, rather, but I want to focus on at least the first portion of what you said about Michael Steele. Being the first African-American leader of the Republican National Committee. And Philip Beverly, your response to what signal, what message can Michael Steele send to African-Americans, and is anyone listening to what he will say? And does it make any difference that now the voice of the Republican Party is an African-American?
Unfortunately, no. As we were talking in the break, the brand is too damaged, and there's just a cynicism out there that any Republican efforts to sort of diversify are a little bit too late. It's 20 years after Ron Brown was chairman of the DNC that a major party had an African American as chair. Now, 20 years later, they're getting on the bandwagon.
Was it viewed as a gimmick that because there's an African American in the White House? Do you think it was a gimmick?
It's not a gimmick. I mean, he certainly was on. It was not a unanimous vote. There were significant challenges, including by Mike Duncan, the incumbent, who thought he was going to win re-election. Thankfully, he didn't, in my opinion. And Michael Steele was the lieutenant governor of Maryland. He ran a very strong race for the U.S. Senate in Maryland. This is not tokenism. This is a very sharp individual with something to say.
Good speaker.
He was at DuPage County Lincoln Day dinner here in Chicago just a couple weeks ago. I had the opportunity to see him speak. He did a nice job. And the hope is for the party and for the nation, especially with Obama in the White House, Michael Steele as one of the leading voices of the Republican Party, is that we can move beyond race identity politics and talk about what people have to say coming out of their heads and not what their skin color is or what their gender is. And I think Republicans would be well advised to do that.
Thank you very much for your call. One of the things that's happening, and again, for those listening around the country, you are probably hearing less and less about the controversy involving our junior Senator Roland Burris, but it is still it's a festering issue here in the state of Illinois. And what happened last week is you had African-American members of the Chicago City Council suggesting that some of the white elected officials at the statewide level who have been very aggressive in calling for the resignation of Roland Burris, including the new governor, Governor Quinn, and other members of the constitutional officers at the statewide level, that they might be walking into a political buzzsaw in the future if they're going to try to run statewide. And last week on this program, we had Susana Mendoza here, who is a Hispanic member of the Illinois House, and she was sharing stories about some of the threatening and intimidating calls that she received after she called for the resignation of Roland Burris. And so I'm wondering, Ralph, because you were certainly in the Chicagoland area at the time of the great battle between a race-based battle that took place in the Chicago City Council less than 20 years ago. Does this represent perhaps the opening of another difficult, messy, very contentious period in Chicago politics if we have black Democrats and white Democrats publicly fighting? And does that provide then an opening, as it has done in the past, for the Republicans to reach out and pick up an office or two?
Well, I think the short answers are yes and yes. I think what you're seeing in Springfield is the Black Caucus has felt that they have not received adequate input into the process down there, that it has been somewhat too controlled by the leadership, which has not necessarily been as responsive to their issues as they care about. And now Roland Burris, like him or don't like him, I frankly think the gentleman ought to resign just because of some of the questions around the answers he gave. And distinguishing between lying and perjuring is probably not the best thing for a U.S. senator to be doing. But
won't look good on a brochure.
Yeah, probably
he
not the best way to go.
He didn't perjure.
Right. But that said, I think it's hitting a real issue. And if you look at some of the data, I mean, I just don't think race-based politics have gone away because race-based differentials haven't gone away. Exactly. The wage gap between whites and African Americans has grown in this nation, in this state, remarkably in the last 20 years by over 100%.
But as Black Democrats fought amongst themselves and, in cases, fought against white Democrats in this sector. And, again, this dynamic, I think, probably works in other, you know, areas of the country as well. But, you know, it's part of the water here in Chicago. I mean, there was an opportunity for Republicans in the past. I mean, Republicans got elected to countywide office because they had support from the black community. Is that likely ever to happen again? Would people turn against whoever if somebody knocks off Roland Burris in a primary, does that mean that some black voters are going to go towards a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate?
No, I think that the Republican can win because African Americans won't turn out to vote. That it won't be, we'll vote for the Republican. They just won't get involved as they see the messiness of the process playing out. If they don't have a dog in the fight, they won't be at the fight.
Look,
Dan Proft.
I frankly think that they're right, but for different reasons. My mission field for Republicans is Latino voters. It's other minority groups where there's a lot more volatility than the African-American vote right now. I think it's unfortunate, but I think it's the reality. I think the African-American community needs to take a hard look at itself and at its leaders. And when you talk about wage disparities in states like Illinois and nationally and what's happened under Democrat watch, guess who's running major urban centers where African-Americans live across this country? Let me tell you, it ain't Republicans. Illinois, it ain't Republicans running the state. So if you don't like the quality of your schools, if you don't like your access to economic opportunity, then you should take a hard look at the party which you vote to reelect en masse without qualification.
But what is it that that party has to do so that they have a little more credibility with those who you're trying to reach out to? I mean, I agree
with the Republican Party has to do.
What should the Republican Party be saying? Because whatever they've been saying for the last 20 years, it's not being bought.
No, the Republican Party has a lot of fences to mend. There is no doubt about that, and not just among African-American voters but other minority groups as well. And one of the things that that we need to do as a party is to really boots on the ground in the black community, talking to folks, letting them know that, let me tell you something, we want the same things for you that you want for you. We just have different ways of getting there than the Democrats
do. How are you going to do that, though, Dan?
I mean, look, I've done it personally. You go talk to ministers' groups. They're not afraid to hear a different point of view. I think you need to really reach out and speak to folks and speak to opinion leaders in their community and say, we are serious about trying to help. Give us a chance to put forward our ideas and our agenda, and we'll hear your feedback.
So part of it is just being there. Part of it is showing up.
I think a lot of it is being there. I think a lot of it is being there to show a genuine interest in their good and you know, in their lives.
Dan Proft is our Republican. He is a commentator for WLS Radio, working with Don Wade and Roma on our flagship station. When we roll on from Chicago, we'll take more calls at 1-800-723-8289. From Bakersfield, California to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289 on America's great radio stations from coast to coast and border to border, and on Sirius XM satellite radio. Joining us tonight is Ralph Martiri. He is the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. You also are you're a distinguished professor now, or distinguished lecturer at Roosevelt University in Chicago, and you also teach at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana?
Yeah, it's Champaign-Urbana Education Finance class at the master's level, but I teach it up here in the Chicago region.
And tell us in 200 words or less, what is the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, and who are you accountable to?
Well, we're an odd duck. We're accountable to taxpayers, and we're a bipartisan organization. So what we try to do is take a very data-based approach to solving these big problems, and we really have to satisfy a diverse political board. My board of directors includes everyone from David Wilhelm, the former chair of the Democratic National Committee, to former Republican Attorney General Jim Ryan, who's a pretty conservative Republican, ran against Rod Blagojevich the first time around here in Illinois for governor. So we really have to not be too ideological in our approach to things. We have to look at the data and say, using sound economic principles, et cetera, here's what government ought to do here.
And you work in a variety of states.
Yes. Right now we have campaigns or work going on in the states of Ohio, Indiana, and Kansas, as well as Illinois, and we also work on federal stuff.
Is there any easy answer to the question about whether or not there is one state where taxpayers get a pretty fair shake, or they get a good return on their tax dollars?
Well, there's a couple of states, actually, you could say that about. I think Iowa does a pretty good job. I think Hawaii does a pretty good job. But the problem is states are so different demographically from each other. You really have to have a solution that matches the demographics of your state, not just the sort of racial and income demographics, but also the industrial demographics, which are as important, if not more important, for plotting out where your future is going to go.
Dan Proft also joins us. He is a Republican. He is also a commentator in the morning on Don Wade and Roma. That is the flagship morning show on WLS in Chicago, and you offer comment. And you have a unique perspective in that you are the only political commentator who also gives weekly update and commentary and analysis of American Idol.
That's true.
Now, where did this American Idol expertise come in?
I'll tell you. I mean, about two seasons ago, the show just hooked me. You know, I just like the rest of America. And so I was talking to Don and Roma about this, and they thought it was just so against type, right, the kind of radical free market conservative political commentator who is, you know, just entranced by American Idol. But it is. It's a uniquely American story show. I mean, it's a guy who could be working in a muffler shop one day, and 6 months later, he's selling 10 million records. So, and, you know, it will shock a lot of liberal listeners to know, but conservatives like myself actually have other interests. We're not one-dimensional cardboard cutouts. We like music, and we like theater and the arts and literature.
Wait a minute. You like the arts? Yeah, I thought you were all against the arts.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. It's shocking. It's such a revelation. I know. Yes, that we're actually multifaceted human beings, too.
Just as long as they don't get public funding.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And you're also you are a media advisor to the village of
the town of Cicero,
which just
clients.
Had an election last
yes,
week.
Yes, my the town president that I have served
support
got reelected.
Larry Dominick,
so one
big, right?
That's right.
So you must have been doing everything right.
Opinions vary, but yes, we, from our perspective, we think so. Yeah.
Also joining us this evening is Philip Beverly. He is an associate professor at Chicago State, been there for about 18 years, and your area of expertise is?
American politics, processes and institutions, and public policy.
And when you were last here, actually the last two times you were here, you were in a unique position in that you're African American, you're a college professor from Chicago, left of center, slightly left of center, but you were not a big fan of Barack Obama.
I was not.
Briefly describe to the audience why not, and has it been affected at all by his election to be the president of the United States?
I was a traditionalist in this sense, that I wanted a president who had executive experience, who could sort of pull the trigger on understanding decisions that fall with him. It's not by building consensus or trying to get feedback from a variety of sources, that I wanted an executive. And my person of choice, and unfortunately is still under some kind of investigation, was Bill Richardson. As a governor, cabinet member, foreign policy experience as a UN ambassador, he was my first choice. And when he dropped out of the race, then I was really left in that dilemma with Hillary and Barack, and fell on the side of the native son here.
And what grade would you give the new president on the executive skills of hiring a team and a cabinet and some of those issues?
Wow.
And vetting the staff.
The vetting of the staff takes him down to about a C right now. Some of his decisions have been really good, really on point, very decisive. But the Daschle nomination, three times at trying to get a commerce secretary, you got to do better than that. Having appointees that are having tax issues. I had this 1993 flashback to Bill Clinton when he was trying to get an attorney general and kept finding that they weren't paying the taxes for their nannies.
Right.
And I'm thinking, oh, here we go again. Didn't we learn anything? I think those are minor sort of bumps in the road, and that he'll get back on track. The Commerce Secretary pick, good one.
I have a question for you, Mr. Republican, and that is at the conclusion of the budget message last week, or the economic message, when he was leaving. I mean, obviously everyone likes to have their hands shaken with, you know, shake their hands with the President of the United States and sign copies of his speech. And I have to give it to Jesse Jackson Jr. He's a chip off the old block, and that he's always on the aisle, and he's shaking hands with whether it's George Bush or whoever the president is, and he did it again the other night. But what can you tell us about this embrace with Tom Coburn and the President of the United States? The strongest hug that Barack Obama got was from one of the most conservative Republicans in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, well, he mentioned Coburn a couple times during the campaign to kind of highlight his alleged bipartisan bona fides, that he and Coburn, for example, had worked together on various pieces of legislation. I mean, I think Coburn is a sharp guy, and I think Barack Obama is a sharp guy. And I think what they both understand is that it's not about personalities. He might be a very nice guy, very sharp guy you'd like to have a beer with. But at the end of the day, the policy differences are what their responsibilities are, and for both to advocate and to fight for what they think is the best path for America. But you can still be cordial and respectful of one another.
Before we take a call, I want to get your reaction, everybody's reaction, to Bobby Jindal's response, official Republican response.
Yeah.
First time in the national spotlight in any significant way, your reaction to it?
I'll tell you what. I think Kathleen Parker had a piece in the Washington Post about this. I think she nailed it. That was not the Bobby Jindal that I've previously seen before. I thought his performance was really quite awful.
I agree.
I thought he was
style or substance.
A little bit of both.
I agree with that.
The style was almost unwatchable.
It was awkward with his hand. I mean, they should have gone in for a close up because his hand was like flapping like a fish out of water.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of the big moment that Kathleen Sebelius had. several months back during the campaign, where this was going to elevate her as a possible vice presidential when she had the response to Bush, and she kind of laid an egg.
Gawky.
Jindal kind of did the same thing. I think Jindal is an extremely sharp guy. I think he's doing some very cool things in Louisiana. I still think he is a rising star in the party. I think, as Kathleen Parker kind of alleged, he got a little bit bad advice from some handlers about trying to maybe dumb down the message, about trying to be Mr. Rogers as opposed to a sharp young guy with a different vision for where America should be as a representative of the party, and it just completely got lost.
And I agree with you. And the night before Slumdog Millionaire won the Oscar, I mean, it was all ready for him. It was all ready for him to home run.
And he did lay an egg. I asked my students about it, and their response was sort of universally, if he's the best that they got, he ought to run in 2012. Barack wins hands down, because that performance was awful.
Did you tell him that the best may be Sarah Palin?
Oh, they've long since written off Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of conservatives
imagine that at, you know, college kids being left of center. There's a news flash.
What about looking at Louisiana and tax and budget accountability issues? Where does Jindal rate as a governor of a state that historically has had not only fiscal problems but ethical problems?
Well, I don't know that he's done enough to clean up the mess that they have in Louisiana. But then again, if we translated him over here to Illinois, I don't know that he could do enough to clean up Illinois. So Louisiana has a long way to go. They still have tremendous fiscal problems. They haven't rebuilt New Orleans anywhere near to where it was. So they're losing all the economic engine that they had there. Their school system is still really one of the worst school systems in the country. Their reliance on property taxes is too high. And so they have a number of significant problems and hurdles they have to overcome. And I don't know if he's going to be able to do them or not, overcome them or not, but I will say I agree completely that he muddled his message. I think that was his biggest failing, is he muddled his message on a national audience and didn't come across as really saying much of anything.
Yeah, but the difference between Louisiana and Illinois in terms of what you described Louisiana, which you said we could ascribe to Illinois, is only one of those two states got hit by a devastating hurricane. So what's our excuse?
Well, I think if you're in the Republican Party right now, you say our excuse is the Democrats control everything.
That's right.
I think if you're a Democrat, you say the Republicans controlled everything for 30 years.
Let's take a quick call. Let's go to Boston. Bob is listening to us on WTAG out of Worcester. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, Bruce, Ralph, Dan, and Philip, I'm enjoying your show. I've followed you for well over a year, and I really enjoy the political debate that's going on tonight. I do have a comment.
Now, you know what I'm going to do? What I'm going to do, we're about to go to a break, and I don't want you to ask the question. I'm going to put you on hold. You're going to have your opportunity. But I want you to promise me something. I want you, starting tomorrow, every day, I want you to tell at least 10 more people about Beyond the Beltway every Sunday night on WTAG, because we want to get a lot more callers from New England. And especially if you happen to be a Republican in New England, you're a vanishing species. We want to hear from you. We want to hear from Democrats as well. But we want to hear some Massachusetts accents on Beyond the Beltway. And we'll hear Bob's question when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Before we go back to calls, let me remind everybody out in Radio Land that the museum has a great benefit coming up. It is Sunday, March 15th. It's brunch with Betty White, one of the all-time greats of American television. It's Betty White in the Empire Room at the Palmer House from noon to 2 o'clock. Tickets are $50. It is a benefit. Museum.tv, complimentary free parking downtown, great lunch, and an opportunity to meet one of the all-time greats, a native of Oak Park, Illinois. That's brunch with Betty White on March 15th, 2009. So, and again, based on the people that are calling in and buying tickets for it, it seems to me that a lot of mothers are taking their daughters and daughters are taking their mothers. So look for the golden girls in your life, whoever they are, and treat them to really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, March 15th. Museum.tv if you want to buy tickets. Let's go back to Bob listening to us in Boston, listening to us on WTAG. Go ahead, Bob, with your question.
Well, I really have a comment. I don't necessarily support Barack Obama's stimulus package completely. I'm a little bit disturbed that the auto industry is getting such a big bailout, and also disturbed that large companies like AIG that continue to waste money on these executive trips get $30, $40, $50 billion extra. It seems like a large amount of money. But I do think that the the solution that the Democrats put forward is at least a potential solution. I am interested in getting more articulation from your Republican guest about a Republican solution other than just lower taxes, because I don't think smaller government and lower taxes is the only way that we'd get out of this problem, and I don't think it's a self-correcting economy. So I'm interested in if the Republicans really do have a solution, if they could expand on that a little bit more.
Dan.
Well, I think actually that history has proved up, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, that lowering taxes and reining in government so that it does not crowd out private investment are real solutions. I think I'm not just talking about the marginal tax rates, income tax rates. I'm also talking about things that have been proposed, like a payroll tax holiday, which the benefit can only accrue to a business if they hire people. I'm talking about reducing the capital gains tax, or certainly not increasing it as Barack Obama proposed during the campaign. So you're not penalizing the investor class in this country, which, oh, by the way, 50% of the country holds equities. So this is not about rich fat cats on Wall Street. This is about Main Street America, as we hear a lot about, and anybody who's got a 401k. Where do these big pension funds, these big public pension funds, these big private pension funds, where do they invest? They invest their money in Wall Street. So when the Dow comes to 7,000, that's why people are feeling the crunch. So reducing the onerous tax burden, regulatory burden, and incentivizing investment and job creation is the way home. 95% of jobs in this country accrue to businesses with less than 500 employees. So I don't believe in bailing out Wall Street. I don't believe in bailing out these big corporations. I believe in incentivizing job creation and small businesses to do what small businesses do in this country, which is create jobs and create wealth.
Ralph, your response.
Well, I mean, you know, tax breaks worked so well under George W. Bush.
Look,
they didn't.
After 2001, they absolutely did.
70% of our economic activity, according to the last report in our gross domestic product, is consumer spending. And the problem with that is most consumers, as in most workers, 80% of this nation's workers from 2000 to 2008 saw their incomes decline after inflation. 80%. Meanwhile, corporate America was profitable. So giving more tax breaks to business is designed to fail, because at most, that's 30% of the economic activity in the country, but it's really less than that because you've got to factor in public spending.
Ralph, let me ask you a question.
Answer is, if you wanted to do a tax relief, you'd focus on low and middle income families who have a greater marginal propensity to consume. That's sort of the trick in the ballgame.
They'll take the money
and they'll spend it, in the local economy creating jobs. And that's what the conservative economist Mark Zandi found when he found that there's positive multipliers for this public spending that creates jobs and puts money in people's pockets, and not a good positive multiplier for tax reliefs. I just want to finish because it's just been disproven.
No, it has not been disproven. First of all, when Kennedy cut taxes, when Reagan cut taxes, when George Bush cut taxes, when Bill Clinton cut the capital gains tax, you saw expansions of the economy. But let me ask you this. If spending 40% of GDP
– 70.
If government spending of GDP, which is approaching 40%, if that's not enough, what's the number?
Well, right now.
What's the number of government spending? Right now. What's the number?
No, right
you
now.
You have the magic answer.
I do have a
magic. We have the right people in government now. Finally, socialism is going to work because the right people are in charge. So just tell the country, what is the policy? What's the magic spending number?
I'll tell you what.
I got one other question. For the mortgages, and who's going to get federal intervention to renegotiate their mortgage and who isn't, tell us how that's going to work. Go down a block in Kansas, Main Street, Ohio, Main Street, Kansas.
Let's go ahead. Okay, really
Ralph.
Simply. In the stimulus package, the things that are designed to work are the things that have really strong multipliers. Investments in infrastructure, multiplier 1.59. Investments in things like education and health, that's a multiplier 1.34. Unemployment insurance, that's a multiplier 1.75. What am I talking about? For every public dollar we spend, the economy gets a multiplier of $1.75 for unemployment insurance, $1.59 in construction and infrastructure, $1.39 in general public spending on education and health. Right now, When the entire economy is contracting, this creates, and once again, I'm going to quote Mark Zandi of Moody's.com, okay? This will create 3.5 to 3.7 million jobs, reducing our unemployment rate by 2% over the next 2 years.
Ladies and gentlemen, the right thing to do is to reduce our unemployment
and make these investments.
I hope you're writing this down. There will be a test on all these numbers next week. Philip Beverly, you got a comment.
I have to agree with President Obama. I could not take any economic advice from the party who ran our deficit up by the brilliant, and I'm all for tax breaks. You don't give tax breaks when you're fighting a war. I'm sorry. That has never happened in our country's history. I'm sorry.
Wait a second. We spent
$1 trillion on Iraq that we had to borrow.
I don't understand this.
I don't get this. Wait.
Ladies and gentlemen, our time is up. Our thanks to our Republican. We're just getting rolling here, and we'll have to have you back in a few weeks to keep this battle going on. Dan Proft, Ralph Martiri, Philip Beverly have all joined us. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Tom Vera-Cruz and the ever-popular Ben Stewart for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.